listening to the preaching ministry of Faith Baptist Church.
This chapter describes very important details regarding the millennial kingdom. We've looked at chapters 15 through, or 5 to 16, describing the series of judgments that will occur during the 7 years of the tribulation period. Then we have learned in chapters 17 to 19 about Christ's second coming, the collapse of the world system led by the Antichrist, the culmination of all ungodly systems from history. And we have also read about the battle of Armageddon that will occur. Last week, we looked at Revelation chapter 20, verses 1 through 6, which described for us the beginning and some things that happened during the millennial kingdom. There will be a period of 1,000 years. At the beginning of this 1,000 years, Satan will be removed from any influence in the world entirely, locked up, sealed, in perfect isolation in the bottomless pit, the abyss. After that happens, for 1,000 years, he'll remain there, and those who follow God by faith from history, whether in the Old Testament, the church age, or the tribulation period, will be resurrected and will rule and reign with Jesus Christ in his worldwide government for 1,000 years. What will happen after those 1,000 years is the subject of our study tonight, and we see that there will be two things John focuses on. First of all, in Revelation 20, verses 7 to 10, he focuses on what happens when Satan is released for a little while at the end of the 1,000 years, verses 7 to 10. Then what we'll see next in the last verses of this chapter is what happens at the climactic final judgment of mankind. Let's begin by looking how Satan will launch a massive final rebellion against God. Verse 7. Now, when the 1,000 years have expired, Satan will be released from his prison. John locates this particular event at the end of the 1,000 years. He's very specific about that. When the 1,000 years have ended, have finished, have expired. He has already hinted that this would occur in verse 3 when he said that Satan was bound for 1,000 years and after the 1,000 years, he would be released for a little while. Now, that was foreshadowing this, that he is released for a little while. He will be released from his total isolation in the abyss, and that will then allow verse 8 to happen. Verse 8 tells us that he will go out to deceive the nations, which is what he did before the millennial kingdom, during the tribulation period and today. He will not be allowed to do that during the millennium, but he will be allowed one final time to do that at the end. To deceive the nations which are in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to battle, whose number is as the sand of the sea. The four corners of the earth here refers to the comprehensive influence that reaches to the most distant places of the world. It's possible that this is simply just a figure of speech to refer to every far-flung place in the planet, because we know that the earth is round, and this isn't some little biblical tidbit here indicating that this is a flat earth we live on. This is a figure of speech referring to the far-flung places of the earth. There'll be no remote place which does not fall under the influence of Satan when he's released. It also may actually refer to something like the four points on our compass: north, south, east, and west, the directions that we measure distance and geography by. Gog and Magog alludes to an Old Testament prophecy in Ezekiel 38 in verse 2. Also chapter 39, verses 1 and 6. This is a very interesting part of studying this passage. When we study this passage carefully to see what is Gog and Magog, we have to look back to Ezekiel 38 and 39. But when we do this, we discover that what Ezekiel is describing has more to do with, not exclusively, as we'll see, the prophecy of Gog and Magog in Ezekiel 38 and 39 does include a reference to the judgment of fire that happens in the battle here. But it also describes a lot of things that happened in the Battle of Armageddon. So, the question is, does the battle prophesied of Gog and Magog refer to the Battle of Armageddon that happens at the beginning of the Millennial Kingdom? Or does it refer to the battle of Gog and Magog, the final last battle here, that appears at the end of the millennium? And if you study those passages, which we're not going to read them all tonight, it does look like it's referring to the Millennial Kingdom because it refers to some things that happen in the Battle of Armageddon that are followed by the Messiah coming and ruling and reigning from Israel and crushing Israel's oppressions or oppressors. It's probably the best explanation to understand that the prophecy of Gog and Magog is referring to both battles as one big clash that we later find out is interrupted by this 1,000-year period of time because it describes things in both battles. And yet Revelation is very clear that the millennial kingdom occurs in between these battles as John lays them out. You say, what does Gog and Magog mean? In the book of Ezekiel, we see that the word Gog refers to an ungodly or ungodly leaders that oppose God's people and kingdom. Magog refers to the ungodly people that follow them. And so, ungodly political, military leaders, the Antichrist and otherwise. Magog, then, the ungodly people and soldiers who follow them. And the point here is that there are these rulers and nations that oppose God's people, and they are referred to prophetically as, climactically as, Gog and Magog. Sometimes Bible students and teachers are interested to determine if there is a particular leader or a particular nation that Gog and Magog refers to. Some may see this is Russia, the bear, or something of this nature. But that seems unlikely simply because, according to John, Gog and Magog is referring to people from all over the world, from all remote places in the world. That is not a particular nation. That is simply people from every nation, from all over the world, gathered together to fight against God's people. And so I am personally not convinced that we should take any time to figure out if this is a particular nation, because according to this passage, this is a reference to the nations from all remote places of the world. Referring prophetically then to nations and leaders who oppose God's people in this great climactic struggle. These people will form a massive army of uncountable number who will gather together for a military battle, and this battle will prove that both Satan, first of all, during his 1,000 years of contemplation and isolation, failed to learn anything. As soon as he is released, he tries to do again what got him into trouble at the beginning of the 1,000 years. Rally the nations to fight against God. It also shows that people in the world will have failed to learn anything from history. To gather from all over the world to fight against God is not a very good strategy, is it? Especially when you decide to go to the very same place on the game board a second time around. Revelation chapter 20 and verse 9 says, "They went up on the breadth of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints and the beloved city. Fire came down from God out of heaven, devoured them." This massive army will converge onto this breadth of the earth, refers to the plains, the flat lands leading around up to Jerusalem. Plains around Jerusalem of Palestine, surrounding God's people who will be located in the beloved city. Psalm 68:68 tells us that God chose the tribe of Judah, Mount Zion in particular, which he loved. Psalm 87:2, "The Lord loves the gates of Zion," Jerusalem, "more than all the dwellings of Jacob." This is the beloved city of God. And it is not a good idea at the end of time to besiege God's beloved city. This is reminiscent now what happens of when God judged Sodom and Gomorrah. Genesis 19:24. And he will do the same thing on a larger scale here, consuming the satanically guided leaders and people who are gathered with fire from above. This will truly be a scorched earth strategy in every sense of the word. Revelation 20 and verse 10 says, "The devil who deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone, where the beast and the false prophet," you could add, "already are. And they will be tormented day and night forever and ever." So at the conclusion of this battle, Satan will be cast out. Now, we've already noted earlier in Revelation, between the bowl and trumpet judgments, he will be cast out from the heavenly realm. Then we see he will be down to the earth. Then he will be cast out at the end of the bowl judgments out of the earthly realm down to the abyss in the underworld. After he's released and this battle occurs after a brief period of time, we see he will be cast out of the world entirely into the lake of fire. And this is the place where, when Satan goes to the lake of fire, he will find that it is not vacant. There will already be two people there. While he spent 1,000 years in the abyss, the Antichrist and false prophet spent 1,000 years in the lake of fire, and now he will join them. This is a place nobody returns from. A place of never-ending torment, actual torment. Not a place of annihilation, as some people suggest. Oh, you go into the flames of fire and you are technically punished for eternity, but you burn up. If going to the lake of fire resulted in being burnt up or annihilated, then a simple question must be asked. How did the Antichrist and the false prophets survive 1,000 years and still be there when Satan was thrown in? And the word torment refers to an actual sensory experience that itself will be endured forever and ever. It doesn't say that the lake of fire lasts forever and ever, but the experience of torment lasts forever and ever. In fact, day and night and forever and ever is a very emphatic statement, very clear statement. Day and night indicates persistent torture, which means there will be no pause. They won't get breaks in the action. It will be persistent torment. Forever and ever indicates perpetual torment. Not only will there be no pause, there will be no end. Again, not to the lake of fire, but to the experience in the lake of fire itself. So, Satan will be cast in. But John then describes that after he is removed, God will then judge all non-believers at the great white throne. Revelation 20, 11 to 15. Then I saw a great white throne and him who sat on it, from whose face the earth and the heaven fled away, and there was found no place for them. Now that John has established the final end of the Antichrist, the false prophet, and Satan, he now completes our perspective of God's judgment against all unbelieving and wicked people otherwise. And this final end occurs at what many of us have heard called, and here called, the Great White Throne Judgment. This double description of a great throne and a white throne indicates both as great, unrivaled authority and majesty, and white, unrivaled righteousness and justice. Describes the throne not just of a king, but of a judge who passes a verdict. Though John doesn't immediately identify the person who sat on this throne, it becomes clear that it was God in the next verse, when he simply says, when people appeared at this throne, they came to stand before God. This truly is the great Supreme Court of the world, standing over all authorities. But John doesn't describe who sits there. It is God. And also he points out that the earth and the heaven, which is a reference, the heaven there is, it's not a self-removal reference as though there's a throne in heaven and heaven disappeared. This is speaking about the outer heavens, the solar system, the galaxies, the planets, the created material world, our world, and the other worlds in the physical universe. All of the material system that God has created will flee away. It will disappear. And all that we will see is God on the throne. This having passed away, John soon describes what this means in Revelation 20 when he says, then I saw a what? After all evil is judged, the formation of a new heaven and a new earth. Why? Because the former passed away. They will replace and restore the first that were infiltrated by the curse of sin and death. Verse 12 says, I saw the dead, small and great, standing before God. The books were opened. Another book also was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged according to their works by the things which were written in the books. Here, John tells us that he saw the dead. He is not referring to the walking dead or some cohort of zombies. This is not an apocalypse in heaven where the zombies take over the angelic realm. This is simply a reference to what John 5:29, Jesus himself teaches, is the resurrection of or to condemnation. Not all resurrections are to life. This is, remember we talked last Wednesday, the resurrection to life, the first resurrection, the resurrection of righteousness. This is the resurrection of condemnation. Daniel 12:2 describes this as the resurrection to shame and everlasting torment. If this was a graduation exercise, there is the graduation exercise of those who passed. This is the graduation exercise of those who are flunking and are being expelled. This is everyone that will appear to receive a guilty verdict. John emphasizes people from all social classes and positions as appearing at this throne, whether small or great. God will form his final verdict based upon not a person's status, but to a person's behavior and response to him, as recorded in permanent, detailed heavenly records, the books. The sea, he says in verse 13, gave up the dead who were in it, Death and Hades delivered up the dead who were in them, and they were judged, each one according to his works. Here John reiterates that these are resurrected people, people who died and were given back from the grave for a period of time. Some wonder, why does he distinguish between the sea on one hand and death and Hades on the other? Not exactly clear. He could just be simply saying everyone who died. Or he could be just subtly emphasizing this, that there are those who died in the sea and those who died on land and were buried underground normally. He may be referring to people who were dead and buried normally and those who died in other ways and didn't receive a normal birth, like people who die at sea. Sometimes people wonder what happens if someone dies and their body doesn't get treated properly. I heard a man preaching on a radio years ago when I was traveling one summer with a college musical team. We turned the radio on down south. I think it was in Georgia, just to listen to something, and we heard a radio preacher, and he had something going. He thought it was pretty good. He said, what happens when a sailor dies in the ocean? And he falls down and he drowns and a shark comes along and eats his body. And then what happens when a bigger shark comes along? And he went through this process like 7 or 8 times until this megalodon basically had swallowed all the other sharks who had swallowed the sailor. And then he said, and by the way, he was not preaching for the resurrection, he was opposing it. What's going to happen to that sailor at the resurrection? And then he said, that illustration proves why the resurrection is a farce. How do you get a person's body after that happens? Well, what John is saying is, no matter what happens to your body when you die, if you're a non-believer, your body will be resurrected. Nobody escapes this judgment. No one gets away. Sometimes we have a fascination, right, if we like to watch murder mysteries. Hopefully we don't have a fascination with trying to pull this off. But the perfect murder... Now, we don't like to think about it in a way that I want to do one, but is it possible? Is there a way to pull off a murder and no one ever know what happened? Well, there is no way to pull off a death in a way that a person escapes resurrection and final judgment. In the same way, it is not possible to escape God's perfect record-keeping in justice. Revelation 14, chapter 20, says, then death and Hades were cast into the lake of fire. This is the second death. Here John announces that even death and the grave itself will be discarded forever. Once death and the grave has been emptied of all people, that vault of death and the grave itself will be removed and cast itself into the lake of fire. Of course, John is speaking here in a personification way. He's speaking of death and the grave as though they were people, though we know that they are not. They are concepts and realities. But that is not the first person to do this. Paul did the same in 1 Corinthians 15:5 when he said, oh, death, where is your sting, Hades? Where is your victory, taunting death and the grave? Where did Paul get this idea to mock death and the grave? Well, from the Old Testament in Hosea 13:14, the prophet Hosea, he quotes, O death, I will be your plagues, referring to Jehovah. O grave, I will be your destruction, and pity will be hidden from my eyes. God will not feel remorse when he removes death forever. The point here is that moving forward, death and the grave will not just be emptied, but they will be removed. Death and the grave will no longer be a threat or a future possibility for anybody, literally anybody. All people will never face that again. In fact, you could say, this will be the death of death itself. Finally, in verse 15, anyone not found written in the book of life was cast into the lake of fire. This will not be the last time John mentions the lake of fire. He's going to mention it one more time in verse 8 of chapter 20 when he lists out the qualities of people that will be cast there. But the point that he's making here is that these people will be thrown to the lake of fire because their name was not written or recorded in the book of life. We've already seen in Revelation 3:5 that the book of life is a permanent, indelible, unchangeable record, a listing out of all the names of the people in God's kingdom, prospectively, the people that will end up in God's kingdom. To not have your name written in this book is to be a non-believer. If your name is not written in this book, then you are not in God's census for his kingdom and his family. So this is the book that you look to see if you belong in God's kingdom. But what about the other books? It seems that John mentions that these other books are the record of our works. And these are the records that God uses to determine the degree of our punishment. From what John says here, we see that God does not judge all unbelievers equally. He gives all unbelievers equal justice, but not all the same consequences. All non-believers will suffer eternal torment in the lake of fire. All sin, all unbelief deserves that consequence. But though all non-believers will suffer unbearable consequences, having not been written in the Lamb's Book of Life, by believing on Jesus Christ, some suffer more intensively than others. No one's suffering will be enjoyable, but some will be worse. We conclude that all non-believers will suffer unbearable conscious torment, some worse than others, based upon the records of their thoughts, their words, their actions. So let's finish with a few takeaways tonight. Three thoughts. First, a righteous reign of Christ is not enough to persuade non-believers to follow him. Satan often is blamed for mankind's failures, and he certainly has a lot to do with it. Though Christ, though in the millennial kingdom, will govern the world with perfect care and justice for 1,000 years under ideal conditions, a vast, uncountable number of people will tolerate his reign and yet refuse to believe in him as their personal God and Savior. When Satan is released, they will quickly coalesce around his influence and will follow him to rebel against God. If someone says, "I would follow God if he didn't allow me to have such a horrible life," or "I'm the product of my circumstances. Satan and the world around me made me do it. If I'd grown up in a Christian home like you, I wouldn't have turned out the way that I did." And you can say to that person, "I don't believe it." Because God could give you 1,000 years of a perfect, peaceful kingdom worldwide in which all your needs are met and no wickedness is tolerated, ruled and governed by perfect people who have been resurrected and cannot make wrong choices. And yet, in that perfect environment, ruled by the very personal presence of Jesus Christ, you would yourself rebel if given the chance because of your own sinful nature. It shows the depth of our depravity, the stubbornness of our sinfulness. It is not just Satan's fault. Second, God will judge unrighteous people with perfect justice. First, God will judge every ungodly person who's resisted him and refused his salvation through Christ. Nobody will escape his judgment, no matter how significant or insignificant they may have been. God will judge the poor, ungodly person of the street just as justly as he judges a billionaire who ripped a billion people off. All will receive justice in judgment. Second, though, God will judge every ungodly person appropriately. He will not judge with a single stroke. He doesn't judge with a one-size-fits-all judgment. He judges all according to their works, some more than others, more severely for more heinous living. Even in God's judgment of the wicked, he is just. He doesn't just dispose of the wicked indiscriminately because they are bad. He disposes and he judges no more than necessary, but as much as necessary. Finally, death itself will be removed as a threat forever. In these final chapters of Revelation, we've learned about the coming removal of the Antichrist, the false prophet, Satan, and of all ungodly. And then we learn about what Paul calls in 1 Corinthians 15:26, our last and final enemy, the final boss, death itself. And death itself is also defeated. Reading about these future events encourages us that though death technically looms in our lives today, we could still fall prey to death technically as believers, and sometimes that technicality is actually a bit painful depending on how we go out. As soon as we die, Paul teaches, to be absent from this body is to be present with the Lord. Death becomes a faint memory, but it still looms as a reality in our lives. There's coming a day when God will cast even death itself into the lake of fire, and the flickery lights of death and wickedness will be turned off on the stage of Satan's charade once and for all. The play will be over. The only thing left will be the formation, the recreation of a new heaven and a new earth that is so wonderful and unimaginable that it should give you goosebumps. And you can know that no antagonists will ever be a part of the story anymore.